This is Matthew Temple, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hello there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya Friedman, what's up?
Hey, not too much. It is time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast.
Cinepod, by some.
Cinepod, yes. We've affectionately become known as the Cinepod. We've embraced it. It's nice. It's short. There's a couple other people out there who claimed Cinepod at one time or another, but I think the Google search shows us now. I think
we got in your face, other people.
Anyway, so Ben, who is on the show today?
I'm very, very excited to present Matthew Temple, the cinematographer of Late Night with the Devil, which I think is, it's a great horror film, but it's also just a very innovative and interesting film. We don't see a lot of films play with style in the way that this does. And it's gorgeous and it's fun and it's funny. And it goes through styles of like the main movie is a TV show from 1977, like a talk show, like a Johnny Carson style thing. In between, there are there's like a documentary film crew, and there's black and white documentary stuff. And then there's a lot of other footage from various sources. And Matthew talks a lot about how he came up with that and some of the ideas that came up with in post. And it really does feel authentic to me. I think it's a remarkable film, and I think it's worth checking out. Even if you're not the world's biggest horror fan, I think it's just solid filmmaking. And it's always interesting to me. I feel like America and Europe and like a lot of the world are kind of making their own movies together. We're all kind of in a giant lump together. And then Australia seems like they tend to be off doing their own thing. And so somebody like Matthew Temple, he's got a storied resume. He's been doing this for a long time. A lot of his work doesn't really make it over to America. And, you know, I feel that way when we talk to people like Aaron McCliskey. They have kind of their own thing going, and I think it's cool.
Yeah, I think that there's some really unique voices and some really cool stuff that comes out of Australia, and I'm excited to check this out. It sounds like it gets your wholehearted endorsement. So I'm
in. Totally. And I think also, like, you know, look at people like Mandy Walker, who some might say was robbed for not getting her Oscar year before last. You know, most of her career was in Australia, and she's just done some amazing, amazing work over there. I'm glad that it's being recognized worldwide. But I what I kind of appreciate about Australian filmmakers in general is they seem to be perfectly happy just doing their thing in Australia.
Not all of them.
If it breaks out and gets worldwide acclaim, I don't think they're pushing back against it. But I think that they have a thriving industry that I think is different than ours. It's different than the industry you and I know.
Mm. I think that is true. I think that we'll need to get someone to come on the show and talk very specifically about the differences between the Australian system and the US system and compare and contrast. But hopefully someone who's worked in both and can do the full breakdown for us.
Yes. And I would once again recommend a documentary called Not Quite Hollywood, which is about Ozploitation movies, which are like the Australian exploitation movies of the 70s and 80s mostly. And those people are inspirational and also kind of ripshit bonkers. And some of them are like Brian Trenchard Smith, still working today. Yes, he has a movie called The Man from Hong Kong that I'll put up against any action film that you throw at me. It's so much fun. Anyway.
All right. Well, so Ben, we were talking a little bit just before hitting record on this episode about Sora and AI. I know it's the type of thing that a lot of people are talking about, but what is our close focus this week?
And now, close focus.
Well, our close focus is more specifically a band called Washed Out released a song called The Hardest Part, and they made a music video entirely in OpenAI's Sora. And as far as I have seen, it is the first such project where someone's made like a we've all seen impressive demos of what Sora can do, but I had not yet seen like someone try and make a whole thing, a whole unit of something out of it. And I still feel I look at this. I recommend anyone listening to this, check it out. some might say it's got the AI soulless dead eye thing going, or kind of like the weird uncanny valley-ness of it. But it really is, I think it's an interesting concept for the video. It was directed by somebody named Paul Trilio, and I'd be interested to get him on here and talk about it because, you know, like, what does directing a Sora-driven music video entail? It definitely has a look. It's basically like one continuous camera push on a very wide angle lens. And I was impressed that Sora kind of got lens distortions and, you know, some chromatic aberrations and other kind of lensy artifacts correct. It has relatively consistent looking characters, which is always a problem with AI, is getting your characters to look consistent. And it has sets that would, you know, you could have built them. But it could have cost a lot to make some of this, because some of this is like really improbable architecture. Also, it's the genre of music, by the way, is chill wave. Never heard of that genre. But it's I guess that Paul Trilio had the idea for this video, like the visual idea, for about 10 years. So he's had this idea for a long time. And Sora enabled him to do a test run of this idea, see if he could make it work.
It's not really a test run. This is the final video released for this.
Yeah. You offended by it? Does it upset you? Are you like, my industry's over? Or what do you think?
No, not at all. But I do got to give a shout out to Matt Allard over at newsshooter.com. And he found a tweet. I don't know if X has changed the name of...
I still call them tweets. And maybe I'm just old man shakes fist at sky. But I still hold out hope that what'll happen is Elon Musk will sell Twitter. Eventually, he'll get bored and it'll go back to being Twitter. So I still call them tweets.
Okay, so Reed Morano ASC posted this following tweet, and I quote, "Want a music video that completely undermines your music and creeps people out? Look no further. Best part is, I'm not even hearing the music because all I can focus on are these weird, mangled, soulless AI, quote unquote, people and their bizarre movements." And then she writes, "Sora, quote, made by no one and stolen from..." And it looks like I have to click here.
I'm going to guess the next word is everyone.
Everyone. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes. So I got to say that I have some agreements with the feelings behind Reed's post.
Okay. But I'm going to say more soulless than the average band trying to act. I'm sorry. You want to see some soulless dead eyes.
Yeah.
Watch an untrained musician attempt to act.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's even more soulless because they're not even souls involved. There's no humans involved. It's like sort of bizarre misrepresentations of the human form and sort of bizarre, you know, doppelgangers here and there because it can't keep the same thing.
If you didn't know that this was AI, how long do you think it would have taken you to pick it out?
Less than a minute, maybe a minute, just about a minute. I mean, there's too many shots of like where the camera is zooming past someone and their face kind of, you know, goes all warbly.
I think it would be stuff like that in the architecture that would give it away to me. I'm not as offended by it as others may be. It would be a lie to say that I love and embrace this, but it's interesting. And I think that what I'm looking at here is, this is my opinion, 5 years from now, we're going to look back at where AI landed within our workflows and what it ended up getting used for the most. I maintain we're not going to use it to make entire movies. I think we're going to use it to make set extensions and to do some of the things that it's already doing okay. I don't feel like I'm ever going to empathize with a character that's completely made up in a computer, but you know.
I think it's very interesting that Silicon Valley, though, that people inside of Silicon Valley are coming to Hollywood and trying to tell the studios that this is the future. And I don't think that what this is really the future. It feels more like animation. It feels like a bad fever dream. It doesn't feel like something that you hit find and replace and all of a sudden your production goes away and now you are left with this. It feels like kind of like a bad caricature of it. And I don't buy the argument like, oh, this is as bad as it's ever going to look and it's just going to keep getting better. This to me is a failed exercise of trying to replace something that isn't really going to do it right. And
well, it is a solution in search of a problem, I think, in that we already make movies and we already know how to do this. It's maybe easier for somebody to make this by themselves, but it's going to be harder to make it into an emotional experience.
You know what that really is wonderful at? It's like a previs. It's wonderful at saying, hey, here's my
million percent. Yeah.
here's my idea for how I would like something to go.
Although I feel like the problem with AI for previs, is, if I may, is that like a lot of the really good previs stuff is sort of built on a video game engine that works with real physics where you can control it. And so let's say you have a jib arm that's 25 feet long, you know what the reach of that's going to be and what it's going to look at. And you can see your depth of field at a certain f-stop and you know where you're going to see stuff. And the problem with AI for previs, I think for just pre-conceptualizing, just like coming up with a bunch of ideas, it'll work. But for previs is that AI is unmoored from physical reality entirely. So you're not going to be able to use it anytime soon in a way that would do that. Now, if there was a way to combine the two where you have like the video game engine basically saying like camera moves here, goes from here to there, you know, we have Adam Driver and it makes an Adam Driver looking character and you, you know, you circle around and it gives you quasi realistic lighting or whatever, that could be interesting. And I think AI could fill that gap. But even if that's the case, if it's previs, then, you know, obviously you're just creating the shot, but you're not executing it. Like, that's not the final execution. I don't know. I mean, like, I think it's okay to use it for music videos. I've been maintaining since I first saw Sora that the people who are screwed are the people who make stock footage of, you know, like waves crashing on a beach, because it's going to be indistinguishable. But also, I would agree that it's like, well, it's indistinguishable because it's using as a data source people who really went out and filmed waves crashing on a beach.
Agreed. I think you make some good points, Ben. I think that we're not going to solve the AI Sora.
Oh, we are. Sort of. We are. We're going to solve it right now, motherfucker.
Okay, well, why don't we get to the interview?
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I saw Late Night with the Devil in the theater probably 3 weeks ago. And was just blown away. It's a brilliant piece of work, and I think an amazing showcase of many styles of filmmaking all at once. You know, and I'm sure that that has to do with the director, but also I feel like your work really shines. So
thank you.
Absolutely. I think it deserves a lot of attention, and I'm a giant horror nerd and I love genre stuff, but I love it when I see genre done in a way I've never seen it done before, because the movie starts out as a straight documentary. Like, we're watching there's an introduction that kind of lays out what happened, and then it goes into basically found footage of a TV show, like a tape of a lost TV show. So you have that look, and then in the commercial breaks, you have kind of this black and white documentary vibe, like someone was behind the scenes filming everything. And then I don't want to spoil anything for our audiences, but towards the end, it kind of just becomes a regular movie in some places. Like, it kind of breaks out of that. So how did you go about differentiating all the looks that you were going to create and make sure that, like, as an audience, we were like keyed in immediately? Oh, okay, now we're in behind the scenes mode. Now we're in found footage mode. And how did you handle kind of the transition from the fake taped television show vibe into more of a straightforward narrative towards the end? How did you handle the looks of all those?
I had a great pre-production period with Cameron and Colin, and they shared a lot of videos with me. They had this amazing lookbook sort of thing, or a Bible, I suppose, that they'd created that looked like a TV magazine. And,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And right from the get-go, the brothers came at me with this word, verisimilitude, which means to make something feel real. And that was kind of the seed for the television show. So early on in my career, I was lucky to shoot a comedy series called Comedy Inc., INC. Mm. And we, as well as doing regular sketch comedy things, we'd also sometimes do a spoof of a movie or something like that. So I had homework that night before we shot those things to go home, find that movie and watch that movie and sort of figure out what it is visually about that movie that makes that movie what it is, that makes any sense.
Deconstructing the visual language of a specific movie.
Exactly. Yeah, the cutting rhythm, the shots, the colors, how they placed the camera, what kind of lenses were they using? Were they, you know, backed off on tight lenses? Were they up close on wide lenses? You know, what was all those language points that made that movie what it is? So I took the same approach with looking at these television shows from the 1970s, many of which are on YouTube. I looked at the camera operation, and you know, there are certain conventions to the 1970s talk show camera operating. First of all, it was in 4:3 aspect ratio, and all the compositions were very central. And whenever a host moved, the camera moved with them.
Yeah.
And two shots were very evenly balanced. You know, so there were just a bunch of things that I kind of went through and, oh, that's interesting, that's interesting. And I'd note that down. And I ended up coming up with a bunch of camera operating rules for my, camera operators. Just as a way to communicate that to my other operators when they came on board so that we all knew what we were doing.
Did you give them like pedestal bases? And in my research, I learned, but I'll let you talk about it. Like, you didn't use the cameras like old tube cameras because you had to do VFX. Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah.
But did you get the pedestal bases so that they moved like those old pedestal cameras?
Absolutely, we did. And that's the thing that, again, you know, when you start any project, there are certain things that feed into your decision about the cameras you're going to use, the lenses you're going to use, the team you're going to assemble. And on this project, it was very clear to me that if we were going to make this feel real, then we had to be shooting on the same platform that they shot on in the 1970s, or indeed today for a studio talk show. So we had three pedestal cameras. They were Sony Venices, but nonetheless, they were on pedestals. Each operator had to do their own focus and zoom and tracking of the pedestals in shot. So yeah, as far as then getting my team together, I was careful to hire two camera operators who really knew what they were doing with studio cameras, because the last time I did that was over 35 years ago.
Oh, wow.
But
you've done it. Like, you understand what looks like it and what doesn't look like it.
Exactly. At least I'd had the experience of working in a studio, so I kind of knew what goes into making it. So I was the rusty camera operator on the team, but the other two were fantastic, and they brought so much.
Oh, so you operated, and then you had two other guys operating.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you, I always find this interesting. When you're the cinematographer, but also you're one of some operators, you're not the only operator, there's, you know, in this case, three operators. Are you basically just mapping out what they're going to do and letting the director keep an eye on the video village, the directors? Sorry, I keep saying director in this. There are two directors. But letting them keep an eye on what the other ones are doing? Or do you have like a monitor so you can see what the other two operators are doing while you're working? Like, how do you bifurcate or trifurcate your brain so that you can do that?
Well, that's another interesting thing, because if we were doing this for reals, we would have had a director or directors up in a control room telling us through headsets, you know, what the next shot is and where to move to. But, of course, we didn't have that. But we still had to react as if that was happening. So, basically, I'd sort of brief the other operators on how we would cover the scene. Again, in pre-production, I did a lot of mapping of the studio. So this is like the set. Oh,
you're warming my heart. That's how I like to break down a scene too.
And I had little cameras, you know, camera 1, 2, and 3. And I was able to sort of move those around like chess pieces. Just to go a little further into that, again, in pre-production, I watched several talk shows and not only broke down visually what was going on, but also in a construction of scene, of the scene sense, I would go through, I would pause the video, I go, okay, camera 1 brought the host in, they cut to camera 2 for the intro, and then I'd play again, and then I'd stop again. Okay, new guest has come in, they've cut back to camera, you know, to the crane or whatever, you know. However they assembled that in the moment in 1970, whatever, I kind of mapped it all out just so I could get it into my brain how our three cameras were going to work, because we were kind of trying to shoot everything in the moment as it happened as much as we could.
Talk about kind of the other two styles that are in there. So when we go to commercial break, it cuts to kind of a black and white handheld documentary, like we're following the various backstage people and stuff around. So like, what was the choice to make that black and white? Like, were we supposed to believe that there was a documentary crew there? It goes like very kind of like a unfunny Larry Sanders show at those moments. Like you're just kind of over the shoulder of these people.
Yeah, it is funny. I mean, you know, there's a certain convenience to a lot of that footage, I suppose, but we were supposed to think there was a documentary crew, in fact, a French documentary crew, as it happens. And again, in pre-production, the brothers had shown me references of documentary makers from the time, and D.A. Pennybaker, I think, was the main one. So, you know, again, I was observing how those came together. But the funny thing is, you can start out with that sort of idea, but we had restrictions that sort of meant that we couldn't be completely free as our documentary camera operators, because there were days when we didn't have the band.
That makes sense.
There were a lot of days we didn't have the studio audience, so we didn't have complete and utter freedom. So in a way, that those restrictions kind of clamped down, I guess, a bit on the freedom available to you as the documentary camera operator.
Well, let me ask you something too. Like, did you shoot the whole thing on the Sony Venice?
Yes.
So the sensors on the kinds of cameras that they would have filmed this on would have been teeny tiny. I don't know exactly what the size of the sensor on a tube camera would be, but, you know, like they were replaced with 2/3-inch CCD sensors in the 80s and 90s. So did you do anything to kind of emulate the way that sensor would look to the Venice? Like, is there a way that you, like, what it, lens choice, lighting choice, f-stop choice, that kind of stuff?
No, that's a great question, Ben. What I did was, being the Sony Venice, we could have shot 6K and large format, and that could have been a choice, but it would have kind of gone against what I was trying to achieve, which, you say, is that kind of, you know, 2/3-inch or whatever it was, tube camera look. So I chose to go to Super 35. And I, again, observed, I didn't, of course, know what the technical specs were for the stuff that they shot in the 70s, but I could observe simple physical things like depth of field.
To me, that would be the giveaway.
So I just mucked around with the camera, the Venice, on set, and sort of felt around, I guess, for want of a better term, to find the T-stop that gave us that same level of drop-off, and that happened to be around T4, I think we ended up, T4, four and a half, something like that.
That's not too onerous.
No. Yeah, that's how I got around that little technicality. So shooting as small a sensor as I could and still shoot 4K, and, just putting a bit of stop on the lenses.
That's cool. That's cool. I was just completely with it the whole way. And it's interesting because I get caught up on verisimilitude, especially in stuff like this. Verisimilitude will be the name of this episode. But when I'm looking at something that's like a found footage movie or a fake documentary, and I'm like, wait, why would the camera be there? Or, you know, who's shooting that shot? Where are we now? And the way it's set up, it allows you to kind of move through these different styles. And I think that, you know, the first whatever 10 minutes kind of teaches you how to watch the movie, but also then kind of holds back a few of its tricks. It was completely delighting as a viewer to kind of see it go there, because it's like no one thinks we're watching a real TV show, you know. we know these actors, we see them in other stuff, so it was like fun to kind of go with that, with the insanity of that stuff, and it really was just beautiful.
Yeah.
So I always like to ask people the first time we have them on the show, when was the moment in your life that you realized being a cinematographer was like a job you could have, and you had the spark of, I'd like to do that?
Actually, when I was a teenager, I saw the Australian film Mad Max, the first one.
Oh,
You know.
Brilliant.
And I was so kind of blown away by that movie. And it was the first time I kind of put two and two together and went, it's an Australian movie. That means Australian people must have made it. You know, I kind of, that was kind of a seed planted, I guess. I didn't kind of act on that because I didn't know how at that age, how I could, but it certainly planted a seed. And then later in high school, I studied photography, and it was something it was just magic. You know, I just loved photography, developing black and white stills and seeing them appear in the liquid. It was a magical experience. So again, that was another kind of a seed. And the other thing I was interested in, and I guess good at in high school, was stage productions. And I performed in several stage productions. And funny enough, I kind of feel like those two passions are what I do now. you know, combination of photography and stage productions. It's kind of where I ended up.
I'm a big theater guy myself. I love theater, and it's interesting because I feel like we don't talk to enough people in film who started in theater or who, you know, continue to dabble in theater. And, you know, I mean, especially for something like Late Night with the Devil, I would imagine having a theatrical background, like a theater background, would really serve you well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there were lots of fantastic real-time lighting transitions that my wonderful gaffer Matt Begg orchestrated for me, and yeah, that's a very stagey sort of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, it's appropriate.
Something you don't get to do very much in a regular
drama. Yeah, it's a real style.
So skipping forward a few years from that, I was very lucky to get a traineeship at the national broadcaster, ABC Television in Sydney. And being the national broadcaster, it had different areas of specialisation. And so there was studio where I first went, where I operated pedestal cameras for the first and last time until late night. And then I spent some time assisting other cinematographers in the documentary department. And I thought, well, this is fantastic. And then I was asked to fill in on a drama because they also had a drama unit. And as soon as I walked in the studio doors, I just sort of looked around and went, wow, these are my people, you know.
Nice.
All these people, everybody seems to know what they're doing. There's magic happening here. There's acting, lighting. I was blown away and felt like that was where I wanted to be from then on. And
nice.
Indeed, that's
so,
the way
so,
it is.
So you didn't go to school. You kind of, or did you go to film school? Or did
I
you
didn't.
Just...
No, I never did, no. No, I just trained on the job, spent many years working under, you know, terrific cinematographers and marveling at what they do and how they commanded their teams, and became a camera operator eventually, and then Steadicam operator, did Steadicam and camera operating for 11 years, and then got my first chance to DP something and sort of never looked back.
So we've talked to a bunch of DPs who are based in Australia or Australians who kind of came up through the system there. I'm fascinated with Australia because being in America, we're so up our own asses over here and we kind of feel like the Hollywood movie system is the only system. And then I feel like Australia since the 1970s, you know, giving us the rise of people like George Miller, who you brought up, but a ton of other people. Australia has like a very vibrant industry of its own. There's a documentary I've talked about on here before called Not Quite Hollywood that's sort of about
amazing.
Australian exploitation. Yeah, I saw it in I saw it at Fantastic Fest years ago, and Brian Trenchard Smith was there to talk about it, and and they showed The Man from Hong Kong, and well, I guess in a sense Australia has always been synonymous with a certain kind of genre stuff, but you know, a lot of it was like that action stuff, like the George Miller stuff, you know. And I met George Miller once and like told him that in film school they showed us, like, we sat there and picked apart scenes from The Road Warrior. And he looked at me like, oh, my God. Like, he had this look in his eye of like, oh, crap, I'm a textbook now. But, you know, like, but he is, you know, like, you know, he invents and reinvents the genre every time he gets behind the camera. You know, he's so, because I feel like what I see from a lot of the Australians that we've had on here is that absolute technical competence, but kind of out of the box approach a little bit, or unusual by Hollywood standards. And I feel like there's maybe just a different expectation in Australia, or the audiences are looking for something fresher than American audiences who, you know, or not just American audiences. I feel like a lot of the world audience kind of falls into the rut of, you know, same old superhero, this or whatever. Even in terms of like a horror movie, I've never seen a horror movie at all like Late Night with the Devil. And I haven't seen every horror movie, but I've seen a whole lot. And it's just so fresh. And I would not necessarily have expected that to come wherever it came from. It would have been a very pleasant surprise. So, like, I'm just kind of wondering about, like, what is nurturing kind of the innovation that's going on?
Budget. I think maybe that's a lot to do with it. I guess we're an innovative bunch, for one, and secondly, we're used to working to a budget, and usually to quite a small budget, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, I think those two things are probably large contributing factors.
But like, you've had an amazing career, like you said, for like 30 years you've been doing this stuff. And, you know, your stuff is primarily Australian. Like, if I'm not mistaken, this might be the first film that you shot that's been distributed in America.
The first film I've shot full stop. Any other features I've worked on was as a camera operator. And yes, certainly my DP career has been in television.
And it's Australian television, and I'm sure that the extremely curious Americans know how to get it, but it's not all readily available out here.
Yeah, so I've spent my working life in television, either as an assistant, an operator, or a DP.
This shows my lack of preparation, but as your first feature, what was the leap? Like, what brought you to direct your first feature and to take it on? Because you have so much experience. I mean, like going through, you know, your whole IMDb, you know, you've been, you know, consistently working for so long. And I feel like, you know, you would be an obvious choice to shoot features.
Look, I guess I just live in that TV world, but what brought me to this movie was a relationship with Colin and Cameron. I worked on their first feature called 100 Bloody Acres, mm-hmm. which is a fantastic horror comedy again, and I worked as the Steadicam operator on that, and they liked my work. I really like working with them. And then I did a couple of television projects with Colin as director, and I shot them. And I guess, it was just a working relationship that's kind of gently evolved over the years. And then they started telling me about this feature film they were going to make, and I was like, oh, you want me to shoot it? You know, it was really lovely that they had the faith in me to do the job for them. And then being, you know, sort of sitting in that seat of making the feature film, I just did what I always do, which is prepare, think about what's going to make the show, and create a set of rules and try to stick to them as much as we could.
I would love to see I'd love to check out the document of the rules and like how you do it, because, you know, everybody has a different way that they kind of even just organize their thoughts about a shoot. And you know, this is such a contained film, but, you know, like when you have a film that's in different locations or different, you know, time periods or whatever, I always wonder, like, how do you track, you know, the color arc, the lens arc, you know, the various arcs as a DP that you're kind of building into it. Like, how do you keep track of it? And I feel like with this movie, those decisions are just baked into the concept so deeply that, you know, it's like it all has to look like studio pedestal cameras. So, you know, you're not going to suddenly have a shot that can't do.
Yeah, exactly. One of my rules was that although we would be shooting this in pieces, in parts, it had to always feel like the three cameras were logically within the space and couldn't sort of move to an extreme angle all of a sudden, you know, because it would have just jumped out. So, yeah, it was making it feel like the cameras had a logic to them and a logic to their movement and placement.
That's so smart. That's cool. Really cool. So are you bit with the bug now? Are you looking to do more features? Are you still doing a lot of television? What's your current passion?
Yeah, I'm in pre-production for a new television project at the moment, which is going to be a beauty. Yeah, I'm just sort of keeping my nose to the grindstone, doing what I do, and hoping for an invitation to do another feature. That would be lovely.
Cool. Well, it's great to talk to you. Before we go, is there a specific place people can go to see your work, a website, Instagram, any place people can find you online?
Yes, I'm on Instagram as DP Wolfie. Mm-hmm. And I have a website, matthewtemple.com.au.
Nice. Well, hopefully we'll get some more people to check that out. Congratulations on Late Night with the Devil, which I believe is now, I don't know if it's in theaters in America anymore, but I know it dropped on Shudder, the horror streaming service that's owned by AMC, and I've been a loyal subscriber there for years. But just amazing work, and it's really amazing to meet you. I can't wait to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I really appreciate your interest.
All right, so that was Matthew Temple. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Matthew. Thank you for making Late Night with the Devil. Holy crap, I just love that movie. I watched it again after it dropped on Shudder.
Hey, Ben, guess what?
What?
It is time to pay some bills. We have to thank our fine friends over at Airy, makers of really great lenses, really great camera equipment, and of course, lighting. Airy is one of the premier lighting LED manufacturers in the world, and they were one of the very first people to introduce professional Fresnel LEDs, and they are back with an upgrade to the original LC series, which they now call the LC Plus. They have the L5C, which is a 5-inch Fresnel, and an L7C, which is a 7-inch Fresnel, and these are up to 90% more output than the original ones. And I know I still own an L7C, so there wasn't the brightest light, but this is going to be significantly, significantly brighter, and it's going to be available in that sort of very traditional silver and blue color, as well as a black color, which depending on what you need, you might want to have it either stand out or blend more into the background. It kind of depends on what you're doing for your studio or production work. And it seems to be very compatible with the original accessories, which is great. And all the details are up over at Airy.com under their L Series Plus section. They're also going to be available, of course, to order from your friends at Hot Rod Cameras. Hot Rod Cameras will be selling these. And, you know, it's a really cool Fresnel. Fresnels, of course, have continuous focusability from spot to flood, and it's a very smooth and homogeneous field of light, and you have complete control over both color and intensity. So yeah, it's worth taking a look at the new L Series Plus if you're a Fresnel person, and you know, maybe Bowens mount's just not your jam. Maybe you like having that optic, and who could blame you, because it's been the standard for a lot of production lighting for a very, very long time. Check out the L Series Plus at Airy.com and over at HotRodCameras.com.
All there right. There you go.
Now, short ends.
So, Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's when we talk about our obsessions or our fascinations or what's really interesting to us every week. What is going on with you? What is your short end?
Well, I'll tell you what caught my eye, and maybe it caught some other people's eyes. I've been talking about this on the podcast for a while, and that's Francis Ford Coppola's self-funded $150 million giant let's hope masterpiece, Megalopolis.
Yeah, and the first trailer dropped, didn't it?
That's what got my attention. It's really less of a trailer and more of just a scene.
Oh,
and it was shot by our good friend, Mihai Mellemare. I was really excited to see that Mihai is the DP on Megalopolis. I guess he's shot Coppola's last two other movies, I think. And it's a very impressive looking scene. A lot of like really strong compositions, a lot of like repeating triangles, and Adam Driver kind of stepping out onto a roof kind of framed in a triangular doorway. It reminded me a little bit of Metropolis, you know, the old silent film. And I'm assuming since it's $150 million self-funded movie that everything I'm seeing is probably a set or a set extension. Maybe not. I don't know. I think it's a really intriguing first look. It totally got my attention, and I think like a lot of people, I've had kind of a mixed relationship as an audience member with Coppola. You know, he's obviously made masterpieces like Godfathers 1 and 2 and Apocalypse Now, and then he's also made movies like Jack, less of a masterpiece, and then he's made movies like One from the Heart, which is brilliant and genius and kind of a head scratcher in certain ways, but like definitely the work of an auteur. And he hasn't made a movie in over 10 years. So it's exciting to see that it's coming out. So I'd recommend everybody check out the trailer. It's not really a trailer. Again, it's more like a scene from Megalopolis.
That sounds super cool. I'm totally going to check it out then.
Definitely do it. It's worth the 2 minutes. How about yourself, Ilya? What's your obsession this week?
I went to the Portland Lens Summit this past week, and it is sort of the like preeminent event for lenses in the, well, in the US and maybe the world. I don't know of another event exactly like it, but essentially all the lens manufacturers sort of gathered together, and there's an opportunity for you to go around and look at and test all the various lenses from all the major manufacturers. If it has to do with cinema, it's pretty much at the event. Now, not every lens was there. One of the lenses that wasn't there is actually the new Blazar 1.5 anamorphic lenses. Mm-hmm. They're actually called the Remus, and the brand name is Blazar. But I happen to have a set, And I brought them with me one day, and I was able to try them in a couple of unique things. And as a point of reference, there's a lot of lenses there, a lot of very expensive lenses, lenses that cost tens of thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of euros. And the Blazar lenses cost about $800 a piece when you buy them as a set of three. Mm-hmm. So it's an incredibly affordable set of 1.5 squeeze anamorphics. Now, interesting, there was a company there called Second Reef, which was introducing their brand new, super professional, super expensive, €34,000 1.5 squeeze anamorphics, and a great way to evaluate a lens to get an idea of the actual performance of it is to put it on a projector. And the great thing about the Pacific Northwest Lens Summit is that Kerner Camera has an industry standard Crozeal TMP72 projector there where you can put any lens you want on and you can take a look at it. So I took one of those brand new $34,000 Second Reef Coral anamorphic lenses and put it on there. And I have to say, it's a very impressive, very special lens. Really looks great. And at 34,000 euro, it should look really good.
Yeah, yeah.
Now we took that lens off and then I put up the $800 Blazar lens. Was the $800 Blazar lens as good as the $34,000 Second Reef Coral? No, it was not as good. But that being said, it was surprisingly good considering the massive gulf in dollars and the massive gulf in size. The Blazar lenses are about the size of your fist and absolutely tiny. And the Second Reef Corals are probably 5 or 6 pounds and, you know, probably 7-8 inches long. They're big hunks of metal and glass. And the thing that I found particularly interesting is that when you stopped down the Blazar lens, and this is true of most lenses, when you stop them down, the performance improves. These lenses improved quite a bit. And when I stopped them down to about a 4-5-6 split, the difference between them and the Corals wide open was pretty insignificant. Now, granted, there's a couple stops of difference of light exposure here, but if you were looking to save, let's say, $33,000.
Or you're going to start making anamorphic documentaries, which I don't know if anyone's ever done that.
It wouldn't surprise me. I bet there is. There's anamorphics being used for corporate videos now. They're being used for all kinds of stuff. But, you know, 1.5 squeeze anamorphic is a little bit less than sort of the normal 2x squeeze, or 1.8 as some of the manufacturers have embraced lately. And can you get an incredible image out of a really cheap lens? Absolutely. And in anamorphic, that used to not be the case. You used to really have to pay to get good quality looking stuff. I mean, Laowa really set the bar high with the Proteus and the Nanomorphs. They've really done well. But as like an alternative, an even less expensive alternative, something that covers full frame. Oh, here's the other cool, crazy thing about the Blazars. I put it on a 65 millimeter sensor. Well, approximately. I put it on the modified Fuji GFX 102 camera, which is a medium format camera. I put the Blazar 45 millimeter lens on there, and it nearly covers its massive medium format sensor. So here's a sensor designed for full frame, but covers way beyond that. I'd say it covered 95% of the area. And this was the widest lens I had, which is a 45 millimeter. I'm assuming that the 65 and 100 probably actually cover medium format. So if someone was so inclined to have a really large sensor and to also get a 1.5 squeeze anamorphic on there, you could do it for relatively low money. And if you could plan your ISO or your exposures to be around 4 or 4.5-6, I know this is getting down into the technicalities and the weeds.
We are so in the weeds right now, but yeah. But
for the people who understand,
we're in the weeds, man. Let's do some weeding.
So for the people who understand the words that I am speaking right now, it is worth paying attention to a very inexpensive little company called Blazar and their Remus 1.5 anamorphics. Of course, they're available at Hot Rod Cameras. Of course, you can place a pre-order for them. And I say pre-order because even though they've been shipping in limited quantities, they really haven't had a lot of them go out into the world. They've been very, very limited since, probably the beginning of this year. So a few sets here, a few sets there. But we've got a pre-order going where you can place a small deposit and then you can get a three-lens set for $27.99 or something like that. I say they compare very favorably to other way more expensive 1.5 lenses out there, especially if you can stop them down just a little bit. And man, if you compare them to some other quote unquote budget 1.5 lenses, you can shoot them wide open. They're pretty much on par and they weigh way less and they cost way, way less. So
to me, the weight is the more interesting thing. The fact that they're light.
I am going to go out on a limb and say right now that there is someone who's going to make a very impressive indie feature, probably shooting on something like an FX6 or some sort of similar sort of camera about that level with these little lenses, and it's going to blow us all away. And it would not surprise me if big movies, maybe something that like Greg Fraser did with the FX3 and Oren yeah. Soffer did with The Creator, it would not surprise me at all if a big movie decides to pick up these little Blazer 1.5s, because frankly, they could be crash cams at this price. At this price, you could put it in harm's way and it's no big deal if it gets destroyed. I mean, $800 lens is nothing to a big production. And the fact that they weigh nothing and they're so small means they could do some really cool stuff. I expect you're going to see them get used in a lot of places, especially because it's not totally clean. It's not totally funky. It seems to kind of be that balance that people are looking for out there. So, yeah.
I have a weird thought. I'm going to ask you this, and I could be like way off base, but has anyone ever put an anamorphic on a drone? Can you do that?
Yes, that has happened a little bit here and there, but I will tell you that most often, at least I know from Michael Fitzmaurice, I asked him about this because he shot a movie that was all in anamorphic a few years ago, and when it came time to do the drone work, they skipped the anamorphic on the drones, they shot spherical on the drones, and truly, a lot of times drone shots end up being on screen for only a few seconds and no one's going to notice. So
yeah,
really,
you just want those sweet, sweet anamorphic lens flares on your drone shots.
Yeah, you don't necessarily need that. And there's so many incredible sort of like, you know, DJI level drones now, especially like the Inspire 3, especially mm-hmm. some of their better ones where you have a really good image, a really good clean image, and it intercuts really well. Spherical and anamorphic get intercut all the time and no one is the wiser. So it would not surprise me though.
I mean, anyone who's watching your movie is like, wait a minute.
Yeah, that doesn't.
Wait a minute, that was an anamorphic lens before we went to the drone shot. I don't want to see movies with that person.
J.J. Abrams, of course, made huge use of anamorphic lenses in like the Star Trek reboots that he did, and really drew a lot of attention to it with a ton of lens flare. But ultimately, at the end of the day, how much does that anamorphic lens play into every single shot and scene?
Like if you were doing a drone shot where you were like going into the sunset or something, or the sun was, you were in the woods and sunlight was peeking out, you were getting lots of cool lens flares, I think it would look awesome.
The whole point is though that stuff can get intercut. You can get away with an awful lot, especially in post. You can do a great job of matching all different types of things. So does anamorphic have its place? Absolutely. Anamorphic was a big topic of discussion at the Pacific Northwest Lens Summit. And I feel like it's not going anywhere. As a matter of fact, there's never been more options. But if you wanted to dabble in anamorphic, getting like a little set of the Remus 1.5 squeeze is a really good way to start. It's not a huge investment and you could kind of throw them wherever you needed to and they cover full frame really easily. So my goodness, it's kind of a fun, good way to go about it. Certainly way more cost effective than many of the other systems that are out there and doesn't really lock you in so much. You could have it just as a spice rather than sort of as the main course, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. All right, Ilya, so that about wraps us up. Before we go, where can people find you?
You can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com in Los Angeles at in Burbank at our flagship headquarters, coming up very soon for Cine Gear and Cine Beer. And then later in June, Portland, Oregon, soon to be opening Hot Rod Cameras Portland. So, I know, it's crazy. We're getting closer every single day.
I'm excited for you, man. I can't wait to come up and visit.
Yeah, I look forward to that. So, Ben, where can people find you?
You can find me at the Starbucks in Sherman Oaks and also at benrock.com. Everything you ever wanted to know about me and a few things you probably
didn't want to know.
You just don't care about. Like a lot of it, you're like, yeah, that's neat, Ben. Anyway, before we go, who do we need to thank?
As always, we have to thank our incredible team. It is not just you and me who make this happen. We have a whole team of people behind us.
Like we'd put out an episode every 9 months.
That's true. We have three stalwart people that really help make every episode happen. Occasionally a rotating cast of other people, but really three people. Number one, Alana Cody, our producer, our show producer, who is doing all of the producer type of stuff that neither you nor I want to, or frankly, are probably capable of doing.
I am just terrible at it.
She is great at it, and she's making it happen for us every single day. I know she's lining up more interviews for us as we speak. We have to thank Kay Zalatrachi, the person who made the music that everyone heard when this episode started, and any other stings and hits and things throughout this episode, all of that music came from Kay's Alitracci, musicbykays.com.
Also thank, as always, our esteemed, amazing editor, Ben Katz, a man with a great sense of humor and an uncanny ability to make neither one of us sound like complete idiots. I mean, I'm not really speaking
well,
for
no,
you.
Well, no, he but could make us sound like complete idiots.
I'm I a dope. It would be a short walk to make me sound stupid. So
he chooses not to make us sound like complete idiots.
And I appreciate so it.
Yeah,
I appreciate
it's a good choice.
It. As
yeah.
a fellow Ben, I appreciate it. So you want to take us out?
If you're watching us on YouTube, please be kind and subscribe. And for everybody else, until next time.
Be kind and subscribe.
Be kind, subscribe. Yeah, you know, kind of like be kind, rewind.
No, I get it. I like that better than smash that like. So
I don't want to ask anyone to smash.
I don't want anyone to smash anything. I just, I have dignity.
All right, how about this one? I'll try it again. Until next time, this has been the Cinematography Podcast.
All right. I hope Ben just leaves that in its entirety.
I think that anyone who watches till the end of our shows is really, they're a super fan and they get to geek out on the way that we don't know how to end this thing. So
that's true.
But I think we're getting closer. I think and error, we're getting down to what it's finally going to be.
All right.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.